Hello, classical classmates. It's me, your host, Daisha. You are about to experience a real treat. I have a conversation in this episode with the music director, or as Todd calls him, the lead dude of the Enscape Chamber Orchestra. They're a DC-based chamber orchestra. And in fact, if you're in DC and you're listening to this in the year 2015, you can go check them out in DC and in December. So if you want more information about them, go to enscape.org. Our conversation is all about storytelling and music, and it's a particular interest of mine, so I got very into this conversation. Speaking of storytelling, if you're listening to us on the internet, which you kind of have to be, chances are you're listening through iTunes. Why don't you take a second, subscribe to our show, and then tell a story in review form about why you love us and give us a nice rating. That'd be awesome. Anyway, enjoy the show. My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock, and I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical, but I really want to learn. So, every week on this show, a classical music expert will give me a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the classical classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with us, all the way from the WAMU studios, home of the Diane Rehm Show, is Richard Sherbo. Richard is founder and artistic director of the DC-based, Grammy-nominated Enscape Chamber Orchestra. Enscape is dedicated to commissioning and premiering new work. Richard studied conducting at the University of Maryland. Among the many things that Richard is busy doing, he's also the associate artistic director and general manager of the National Orchestral Institute. And he and Enscape just put out a new CD. It's a new transcription of Stravinsky's Petrushka. Richard Sherbo, welcome to the Classical Classroom.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So what are you going to be teaching me about today?
Well, I was looking at our recordings and thinking about what we could talk about today. And it really struck me to think about the element of storytelling and pictorial description that's present in a lot of our music, and especially with the ballet Petrushka that we just recorded. Obviously, there's lots of great storytelling and imagery in that piece, so I thought we could talk a little bit about that and hopefully hear a little bit as well.
That sounds great. Story is one of my favorite things in the world. I'm really kind of fascinated with how the human brain just sort of is drawn to story and how it just kind of sucks us in. We're sort of helpless when a good story is around, you know?
Yeah, well, I think in ballet, you know, when we listen to this great music, Stravinsky wrote three of these wonderful Russian ballets, the first one being The Firebird, this one being Petrushka, written in 1911, and of course his very famous Rite of Spring, which was known to cause riots at its premiere in Paris. But each of these, of course, on stage has an incredible visual element that is missing when you're hearing the music. But Stravinsky is such a great orchestrator and a great composer that you can hear this imagery, you can sense it even when the visual elements aren't there in front of you. So it'll be fun to dive in and hear some of that at work today.
Well, so I'm curious, when I think of story, I think of a story that's written on a page or a story that somebody's telling me, but it's always got something to do with words. When classical music, this wordless music, tells a story, what do you mean? Like sans ballet, sans dancers, like what do you mean by that?
Oh, sure. Well, that's a great question, and every composer approaches that differently, of course. In the music world and in your music history class, you learn about absolute music, which is music that composers meant to be heard without a story present. Mm. So something like Beethoven's Fourth Symphony doesn't really have a story that, unless you choose to make one up yourself in your own imagination, but the composer isn't trying to depict a story itself. Then we have this genre of music called program music, where the composer has a visual element or has a story in mind, and how they choose to express it in music differs from each composer. You know, we have these wonderful tone poems of Richard Strauss, Till Eulenspiegel, Ein Heldenleben, where there's a really strong element of either self-referential storytelling or telling of Germanic tales. Which differs a little bit from ballet music, of course, because what we're hearing today is the music without the dance. And so I wouldn't quite call this program music, but again, the orchestration that Stravinsky has and the music itself is tied so closely to the story that it's really fun to know what's happening when you're listening to this.
I'm curious, so when a composer sets out to write music like this, they're conveying emotions, they're conveying perhaps a story, and then the listener is creating a story based on that in her own mind. And is that a problem? I mean, like, or is that the goal for the composer? I mean, is it, it's kind of a weird question, but like, people are creating their own stories based on the music in their minds. Right. Is that an issue? Is the composer's goal to try to get them to see their story?
Wow, that's an interesting question. I think that that's really one of the beautiful things about music, and especially about classical music without words. You know, in popular music, we have words to tell us what to think, and of course, in opera and in Lieder, we have words to depict what the composer was thinking. But I think one of the most enjoyable aspects of so-called classical music and music without words is that we can use that beautiful imagination that we're all endowed with as humans to come up with our own story. And the composer can set us in a certain direction with either the title or with program notes, perhaps, or within movement titles. But it's up to us to create that imagery. And I think that's a real beauty to music itself.
That's really unique. You know, I can't really think of an analog for that in any other sort of media. Like, nothing is leaping to mind. Well, let's get to some music.
Should we hear this crazy story?
Yeah, let's do it.
So I want to start off by just giving you a really quick overview of the story of Petrushka, and I'll try to be brief so we can get to the fun music. But Petrushka is a story about three puppets and their loves and jealousies of each other. And the three puppets are named Petrushka, and we don't know the names of the other two, but the other two are a ballerina and a handsome soldier figure titled the Moor. And these three puppets are brought to life by a magician during the Shrovetide Fair in Russia. And the ballerina and I should say the Petrushka falls in love with the ballerina. But of course, in classic storytelling sense, the ballerina rejects Petrushka and she prefers the handsome soldier. And Petrushka becomes angry and challenges the Moor to a fight, and the Moor kills him. And at the very end, Petrushka's ghost rises above the puppet theater, and he shakes his fist at the magician who brought them all to life, and then falls down again and dies a second time as a ghost. So this the ballet unfolds in four different tableaus, but I'd like to listen to the first one today. And this is the Shrovetide Fair. So this is imagining if you were to show up to a carnival or your state fair, and there's all sorts of different booths and food vendors, and maybe it's sort of like the Renaissance Festival, but we don't have Renaissance-style music. But the point is that it's bustling with energy, and as Stravinsky goes through this tableau, we get little interjections from different parts of the fair. So you'll hear a merry group of dancers passing by. You'll hear the master of ceremonies at the puppet theater appear on the stage. You'll hear a passing organ grinder with a dancer. And so all these things come to life, and we can point it out as we go through, actually. It might be fun to listen to this first tableau.
Okay, let's do it.
So here's the celebration. Lots of swirling, undulating rhythms portraying a bustling street carnival. This is really setting the scene. It goes on for a few minutes here. And here are the dancing partiers coming through the scene. They're going to be interrupted here with the puppet master. Here's the puppet master.
Sounds like a troublemaker.
Here's the organ grinder. Back to the puppet master. Oh, and just the organ grinder comes back again. So you can sort of hear how it's almost as if you were looking through a video camera and you were walking through the festival and you were panning left and right, and whatever was in the frame at that moment sort of comes to the forefront.
I'm always trying to recognize leitmotif when I hear it because it's one of the first things I learned on the show. But is that kind of what Stravinsky is using, like little motifs so that you could pick out a character in the music as you're listening?
Right. I think that certainly certain composers really placed a lot of emphasis and formal thought on what a leitmotif was and how they brought it back throughout a piece. But here Stravinsky is certainly setting up associations with certain tunes. With the organ grinder that we're hearing in the background now, it definitely does sound a little simple, like the type of tune that would be coming from an organ grinder. So I guess you could call it a motif.
Okay, it's motif-y.
Motif-y. So the organ grinder's been playing for quite a while now.
Ooh.
Back to the puppet master. And these are the dancers again coming by.
Todd is getting down in the studio.
Is he really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's doing some crazy dancing.
Can we put that on the website?
I absolutely.
Okay. So this goes on for a few more moments or so when we hear all of these different themes happening in close succession, and we're actually getting set up for the second part of this first tableau, which is where the magician appears and actually brings the puppets to life.
Okay. So obviously this story, like, he's employing a lot of symbolism. Well, first, I guess I have a question, which is where does this story come from? It sounds like a fairy tale. I'm assuming Stravinsky or whoever wrote the ballet did not write this story, but maybe I'm wrong about that.
Right. So the story of Petrushka is actually a very old one and exists in a number of different cultures. Sometimes it's known as Punch and Judy, this sort of mischievous puppet character that duels with the soldier or Moor in this case. So what we just stumbled upon now is the magic trick where the magician appears and we can hear sort of mysterious music happening. Mm-hmm. There it is. So the magician appears from inside the theater.
Very sinister sounding.
And he's about to pick up a flute.
The evil flute. It sounds nice enough.
So I imagine him here. He's now playing on the stage for the audience. Mm-hmm. And here the curtain opens and we see Petrushka, the Moor, and the ballerina for the first time lying on the stage, lifeless. The next time we hear the flute play, he's going to touch the flute to the puppets and bring them to life. And then a joyful Russian dance occurs. And now he's touching them. Second one. And the third puppet. And now they all jump to life and dance on the stage together in this Russian-sounding dance.
And the symbolism in the story is so interesting. Like touching them with a flute makes them come to life.
And right, and hearing them, each time he touches them, you hear the flute play the little flute theme. So this actually, this dance actually closes out this tableau, which I imagine goes on for a few more minutes.
Okay.
So this is an example of some of the tools that Stravinsky uses to really not only connect the story through the ballet that's happening on stage, but to add elements of music that portray the story as well.
Yeah, that's so you seem to be kind of suggesting that he doesn't really rely a lot on leitmotif. That's not really his bag.
Yeah.
What kind of musical tools is he using?
Well, Stravinsky was a master of using the orchestral color. You know, he came out of the Russian school where we had composers like Rimsky-Korsakov, who was a master of using the orchestra and exploring new colors. And you hear in Stravinsky's Russian ballets, these three ballets that he wrote for Sergei Diaghilev, the amazing amount of colors that have never really been heard from an orchestra. If you hear his next ballet, The Rite of Spring, where he kind of takes this ballet to the next level and explores even more wildly fantastic elements of orchestration, it's said, of course, that that was one of the reasons why they rioted at the premiere of that piece. So to answer your question, I would say what Stravinsky relies on are elements of rhythm. And in this story, which portrays a scene of a Shrovetide fair in Russia, he's quoting Russian folk tunes, maybe not specific folk tunes, but the rhythms that are associated with it. And certainly the people would recognize that rhythm as a dance and associate the story with that element. So I'm just curious, impression of hearing that? Did you hear the colors, or could you hear some of the story being depicted?
I really could. And I was thinking, it kind of reminded me of watching like an old musical with like a Gene Kelly sort of thing.
It does have that sort of humor to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, where you've got, you know, you enter the town and things are crazy and people are doing things everywhere, and then And then you kind of zoom in on the little story that's happening. It's very, like, cinematic in its scope. And even some of the sounds that I heard toward the end, like when the puppets come to life, like that little ding ding, like that is very characteristic of like American musicals that I've heard.
That's a really interesting comparison. I hadn't thought of that before, but certainly thinking back to some of those movies, you had these great, you know, we had this great tradition of Hollywood soundtracks that are certainly different in today's modern world, but people like Bernard Herrmann and Korngold and these composers that really grew out of a classical tradition and brought these sorts of compositional elements to early Hollywood films. That's really interesting.
I had not thought of. Yeah, because, yeah, those guys were coming, they came over to the States.
That's right.
And got involved in making movies because they were sort of fleeing various oppressions, from what I understand. So that's really interesting. Whoa, connections have been made. Synapses firing.
So if we have time, I'd actually love to compare this piece to another work that we've recorded called Black Bend,
yeah.
Which this music is very lateral in terms of how the music unfolds. And if we look at a piece like Black Bend by Dan Visconti, which was on our album American Aggregate, here Dan sets up what is like one large picture with a story, but it's not portrayed sort of in time. So in the Stravinsky mm-hmm. Ballet, we heard the story unfolding at certain moments. And with Black Bend, you hear the entire story sort of happening all at once, more like a giant picture.
Interesting. Okay. Well, let's hear it.
So this story is recalling the legend of a railroad bridge collapse on the Cayuga River. And we uh-huh. have these two violins. There's actually two players that are acting almost in a dueling sort of fashion and mm-hmm. very blues influenced. And you hear this sort of painful mm-hmm. blues style singing emanating from their violin playing.
Whoa, what's that?
So these are the ghosts and the spirits of those who perished on the river collapse emerging out of this texture. It almost sounds like the bridge is breaking with pieces of wood
yeah.
and crickets and night sounds happening.
It's very spooky.
And from this, we're going to have our two violins slowly emerge into a beautiful blues-like section.
Whoa, that's a really interesting sound.
So the violins there take their bows really close to the bridge of the violin and really close uh-huh. to the lower half of their bow and make this ponticello sound is what it's called in music. Just scraping really eliminates a lot of the pitch of the sound.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I hear that. And now we're getting blues. Going. Yeah.
So to your comment earlier, I picture, as this story unfolds, two folks sitting on their front porch recounting the legend of this train collapse, and now they're having this conversation back and forth, recalling the terrible evening.
It made me, you used the word tableau when you were describing Petrushka, but when I think of the word tableau, I think of one of those... when people reenact a painting, but live, using live people, they're dressed as like...
Oh, yes.
That's what this sounds like to me.
Yeah, this piece is more like a snapshot, looking back in history, and you're hearing the whole story at once, almost. It's not super lateral in the way that it unfolds.
Yeah.
So things are going to get heated, and the full blues band is going to erupt out of this very soon.
Wow. It reminds me of when I was a kid, I had these books that you followed along with a record that came with the books.
Oh, yes, and I remember those.
Yeah,
it was that the little white plastic record player that had the special little plastic records that went on top?
Exactly. I can't remember. It was a Play School, I think was.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. Yeah.
And you would take the little square record out of the book and then play it and flip the pages as it went, and it had all of these sound effects in it. And I remember one that was about a haunted house. It was a Disney book about a haunted house, and it was super creepy, at least to me when I was a little kid. And so this sounds like that had a collision with some blues music in the background. That's what that piece sounded like to me.
Yeah, I mean, the blues influence there is really strong. And what I really like about Dan's music, and we've done a number of his pieces, but even the blues element aside, it has this really strong American feeling to it. Just the opening of this piece, you sort of feel like you're standing in a summer field at night and hearing the crickets and, imagining in the distance this railroad bridge. So a piece like this actually allows the listener a little bit more freedom with their own story. I find myself doing that just now as I'm talking to you. Mm-hmm. Dan's notes about the piece are very brief, just talking about the legend of the railroad bridge collapse, but in my mind, I'm already picturing that it's night, that there are people on the porch retelling the story depicted through the two dueling violins. So this piece allows for a little bit more creativity in that regard.
Yeah, I was seeing these Disney characters sort of mixed with characters from True Blood coming out of this bridge. It was very confusing for me, all the emotions. Well, I have a final question for you, which is kind of, it's a little obtuse, but why do you think that the human brain needs story. We use it to understand the world around us. We need that lens to understand things around us, to connect with others. And like bears don't need that. They just function in the world. But we need story. So why do we need that? And how does music, what dimension does music add to that? What's special about it, I guess?
I think I would have to say that, you know, we have this amazing capacity as creative people, and that music, when we're hearing music, excites one of our senses, which is our hearing and our ears. And there's so much extra gray matter in our brain that wants to go along with that. That I think it's just I don't know. It's just something that our brain naturally goes to. I think it's something unique that's within human creativity that animals and bears don't have. I don't know if I have the right answer for that. Some people I know, for when they're listening to music and classical music, it actually for them soothes them and probably turns off the other active parts of their brain. They find it relaxing, and that's a time for them to detach from other thoughts. So I think for different people, it does different things.
Yeah. I almost think it's, if there is a thing that separates us from the other mammals on the planet, maybe that's it, is our capacity and need for story.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe. Just a theory.
Well, it's a good one. Richard, I like it.
Thanks. Richard Sherbo of Inscape, thank you so much for being on the Classical Classroom today. This was really fun.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, everybody, that does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom. And you know, if you really loved us, you would subscribe to us on iTunes and then rate and review us. But you know, whatever. You can listen to us wherever these podcast things are found. Follow us on Twitter and Tumblr. Email me at dclay@houstonpublicmedia.org. Thanks to audio producer Todd Tiny T-Rex Arms Holslander for twiddling knobs. Thanks to program director Sinjin Flynn for the cortisol boost. I like to live on the edge. Thanks to editor Mark DiClaudio for his piercing, laser-shooting eyes. Thanks to Richard Sherbo for being here today. Thanks to me for saying words. But most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.